The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
Hi, Patrick Cox here. And for everything we say, all the words, all the content, all the meaning, we also include a whole load of fillers, of pauses, of hesitations, of, you know, uhs and ums and other funny noises that we make. For example, how long is it going to be till this very familiar person posts, I don't know, three such fillers?
Everybody, please have a seat. Nothing fills me with more hope than when I hear incredible young people like Neha and all.
Okay, that took about 11 seconds, three hours in 11 seconds. And that's not out of the ordinary for Obama. The presidential archive, I assure you, is stuffed full of many more hesitation-filled sentences. But I wouldn't cherry-pick like that. And actually, some other political leaders, they can beat 11 seconds. Like Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte.
Ik heb er niet gewoond zelf, maar mijn broer woont hier. Ik heb gewerkt in...
Bravo, that took 5 seconds. But truth be told, I did cherry-pick a bit there. The point is, everyone, including the most articulate and smoothest of politicians, they all say or ah plenty of times. Though in Dutch, ah is spelled E-H. Well, as it happens, something is happening with the usage of these expressions, and it's happening across several languages. Here's the Big Show's Ari Daniel.
The first thing you need to know is that and are somewhat different beasts, at least according to a linguist like Mark Liberman at the University of Pennsylvania.
There's a fair amount of what you might call hesitationology research going back 20 years or so.
Is that a real word?
No, it isn't. I just made it up.
But as a linguist, you can do that.
I'm allowed, yes. I'm authorized.
But back to the point.
It does seem to be the case that generally signals a longer or more important pause than
Liberman's been studying hesitationology for almost a decade. Of course, not exclusively, but he's made a rather curious discovery.
As Americans get older, they use more. And at every age, men use more than women. But if you look at exactly the opposite is true.
That is, younger people say more often than older people. And no matter the age, women say more than men. I'll get to why this might be shortly. For now, let me just say that nobody, not even the linguists, expected this result. Because until they studied these hesitations, they thought it was more about the amount of time a speaker hesitates versus who that speaker is. Now, sometimes they let Liberman out of Pennsylvania.
Yes, there are conferences all over the world.
Late last summer, he attended one in Groningen in the Netherlands. During a coffee break, Liberman was chatting with a small group of researchers. He brought up his finding about the age and gender differences related to and which prompted the group to look for that pattern outside of American English, in British English and Scottish English.
These are kind of loosely based on all these photos that I took in
German, Danish, Dutch,
and who you eat hort, that is for
and Norwegian. And the result, says Martijn Wieling, linguist at the University of Groningen.
In all cases, we find the same thing.
Namely, it's just like the U.S. data that Mark Liberman analyzed. Women compared to men and younger people compared to older people say more than The conclusion is that we're witnessing a language change in progress.
And that women and younger people are leading the change.
This is typical of most language changes, that it's these groups who lead us forward. This is known. But why is our future, across at least two continents and five Germanic languages?
Well, that was the first question I asked myself when I saw this data. You know, why on earth is it happening?
Meet our final linguist, Joseph Fruwald, a sociolinguist at the University of Edinburgh. He says that yes, and may be used slightly differently, but as far as he's concerned, they're pretty much equivalent.
When you have two options, you can start using one more frequently and maybe replace the other one so that it's no longer an option. So why it's just one of these things. there's always a little bit of randomness to the whole situation.
Random in that we don't know why changes in usage like this happen or when the next one will be. Fruwald admits linguists are terrible at predicting the future, worse than meteorologists. Language, he says, is even more chaotic than the weather. Now, as for how such a linguistic trend might have jumped from one language to another.
There are some documented cases of that kind of thing happening, usually where people can speak both languages and sort of borrow features of one into the other.
With English being the most likely to influence the other languages. But we still don't know whether this is what's actually happening with More research and more linguists are needed. And as for the future, and may yo-yo back and forth in terms of their popularity, or we may well be watching the extinction of from our lexicon. So would you miss
I don't have a really strong emotional connection to either of these, although based on my age demographics, I'm likely a high user, so maybe that's where I should throw my loyalties.
With all due respect, I don't think Fruwald will be leading the revolution, though. He just used three times in that response, asserting his loyalty to For the world, I'm Ari Daniel.
I wonder if after hearing that, we might all become just a little bit self-conscious about our usage of these noises. I mean, if you're a man of a certain age, would you want to be caught saying when you could shed maybe decades off your perceived age by throwing in a few uber-hip This could snowball fast. Okay, staying on the subject now with Michael Erard. Michael is a language writer, a friend of the pod, an FOP, and he's also the author of a book called Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders, and What They Mean. I talked with Michael when the book first came out in paperback. That was in 2008, pod year zero. Of course, back then, much of the research that we've been hearing about hadn't been done. In any case, here's what Michael said led him to look into the subject.
You know, I was curious about the origins of the notion that good speaking is always umless speaking. And so I went looking back as far as the ancient Greek rhetoricians in their handbooks about how you should speak in public. And they have lots of verbal crutches and tics and habits of people that they hate that drive them up the wall. I think it was Quintilian who hated people who sound like they're singing when they speak. But there was no mention of avoiding and or hemming and hawing. And I took it as far as I could up into the 19th century in the United States, where there was quite a lot of attention paid to how you speak, how you present yourself in public. So lots of elocution handbooks, etiquette guides, things like that. And nowhere there was there a mention of avoiding these things either. So the question is, well, maybe people didn't say those things back then. I was curious to find that the earliest recording that we have, the earliest extant recording of Thomas Edison, the first word that he says in this recording is the word
That's
and that's from 1888. So, you know, at least in 1888, people were saying it. And then I found a poem by Oliver Wendell Holmes in which he has a character dispensing advice to young people, young men particularly. And he says, leave the us out of your speech. What's interesting, in the poem, he rhymes burrs, B-U-R-R-S, with ers. He spells them U-R-R-S. And that's a point that I like to bring up. And I mean no disrespect to English spelling and to British pronunciation, but ER is a British spelling of because, right, you're in your pronunciation, you're R-less, word finally. And ER is not pronounced as a lot of people try to pronounce it. It's pronounced
Right. You note that pretty much every language has its own version of the or the I wonder if in certain other languages that amora is always considered a verbal blunder or hesitation. Or in certain other languages, do they enjoy a higher social standing?
That's a question. That's a really interesting question. And I was never able to get at that. You know, there's an aspect of the filled pause that does seem to have a quality across languages and across cultures that what you're doing is filling a space. And so it seems to be associated with power. And so people who have power or who have control of a conversation feel free to take up time and sort of fill up the social space with these sounds. The way that it works in American culture is that it's men who will say and more frequently because they don't want to be interrupted. So even though they won't know exactly what they're going to say next, they're signaling that they don't want to be interrupted. Now, whether in public forms of discourse, if in other countries and cultures, it carries quite the stigma with it that it does in English-speaking cultures, I don't know.
Right. I've always tried to work that out, especially when I've been doing interviews that have been simultaneously translated. You can hear the hesitation or the pause filler in the foreign language, and you make it out after your interviewee has committed it five or six times. And sometimes it sounds really impressive, and sometimes it sounds like grasping for something to say or want to keep control of the discourse.
I had a great conversation when researching the book with a woman who was a sign language interpreter, American Sign Language. And she was at a meeting signing for someone who was giving a spoken presentation. And it happened that this person said, a lot, so much so that it was part of his personal style. And it was certainly a quality of the presentation as a whole. And from her perspective, making a professional judgment on the fly, on the spot there, she decided to put in all of the ums. And the way that you sign in the ASL form of it's taking your hands with your palm towards you kind of at chest level and kind of doing a circle out and then back with your hand. So she was doing this and she saw the person in the audience who was deaf become increasingly agitated because, as it turned out later, he felt that the insertion of these ums was distracting and that she should have cut them out. And he confronted her later and accused her of being a terrible interpreter because she hadn't taken any of these ums out. And I think she had a perfectly legitimate argument for why she should have left them in.
Michael Erard, author of Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders and What They Mean. He's also the founder and editor of the fabulous online language magazine Schwa Fire. I'll post a link to that at pri.org/language. Also there will be a little bit more on some of the recent research. What was it Mark Liberman called it? Hesitationology research. Well, that'll be there at pri.org/language. Also at the World in Words Facebook page. The other place you can get a hold of me is on Twitter. I tweet as Patricox, PatriCox. There are lots more great podcasts over at the Soundworks Network. You'll find them at soundworks.org. I'll see you next time.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. The World in Words is also supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.